Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Hey everyone, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us. Thanks for joining us.
I have a really stupid question, and it's a little late in our lifetime on this podcast for me to be asking this. Do we use the same music on Tuesdays that we do Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday? That's a serious question because it sounded totally like not usual. Do we? Okay. All right. Okay. Juan Carlos is looking at me like I have three heads.
I know. Now I'm like, do we start it in a different place? You've made me question my entire existence.
See what I mean? It just caught me. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. I'm Kai Rizdahl. He of the stupid questions. It's Tuesday today, our weekly deep dive into a single topic. We're going to talk about onshoring today, bringing factories back and production back to the United States from overseas, which is to say the opposite of offshoring, perhaps. And look, with all the supply chain issues we've been having and the tariff thing that we went through in the late Trump administration and, oh, by the way, early Biden administration, maybe not a bad idea. I don't know. And how do people actually running the supply chain feel about that?
Well, and this has been this ongoing conversation because it's sort of the opposite of globalization as giant economic impact that like hollowed out the middle of this country and got rid of manufacturing and all these industries went away and there wasn't like reskilling and job training, right? So it's sort of this convergence of longstanding and relatively recent events leading us to ask this question, like, why can't we just make stuff here? And there was talk that we would, in fact, see lots of companies bringing manufacturing back for everything from like masks and gloves and testing kits to semiconductors. And so we wondered, are we doing that? Is that happening?
Megan Green is back on the pod. She's an economist, also a senior fellow at the Kennedy School at Harvard, also chief economist at Kroll. And as you'll hear in a minute, she sometimes writes for the Financial Times. Megan, welcome back to the pod.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let me ask you the sort of sequencing question first. Did I have it basically right that as these tariffs ramped up and then the pandemic hit, everybody said, ooh, wait, we need to not be offshoring anymore? Is that basically right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's part of a much bigger, more global trend of economic nationalism that we saw when Donald Trump was elected, when we had Brexit, and then when we had this big trade war between the U.S. and China. Part of the stated aim of that actually was to bring good manufacturing jobs home to the U.S. And so this has been a trend. And when the pandemic hit and much of the West was left without any personal protective equipment, lots of people said, you know what, we really need to be thoughtful about producing stuff at home that is a national security requirement. So maybe we should onshore. And so most economists, myself included, thought this pandemic was really going to prompt a big acceleration of the trend we'd already started to see, where we have deglobalization and companies are basically packing up their toys and going home. That's the narrative. The question is whether that's actually happening.
Sounds like maybe no from your sounds like you might be building up to a no.
Yeah, you got me. So I think we economists have been intellectually dishonest in just putting this narrative out, but nobody's actually gone and checked to see what's really happening. And to be fair, it's really difficult to check out whether it's happening, particularly if we're looking at sort of post-COVID, whether this trend is happening, because we don't have that much data and a lot of the data is really lagged. So the best data source we could use is put out by the OECD. It's actually updated this week all the way up to 2018, which doesn't even include the pandemic. So it's not just that we're being intellectually dishonest. It's that our data isn't very good, but there are some things we could look at to get a sense. One ratio, if you're looking at kind of the exchange of goods and services across borders, is a ratio of world trade to world goods. And it increased massively from the 1970s until the global financial crisis. But since then, it's just kind of gone sideways. So it means we're not globalizing as fast as we were, but are we actually deglobalizing? I think the answer to that is really no. Also, you'd think if we had companies just pulling up sticks and moving back home, trade balances should shrink. But if you look at the data, the U.S. trade deficit just hit a new record as imports soared in September. China's trade surplus on the other side of that is way above pre-pandemic levels already. So the trade data itself doesn't suggest that we're deglobalizing. So you can look at other things. You can look at flows of money. So if we're less globalized now, then you would expect that, you know, American firms would invest much less in China and vice versa. But actually, China's just overtaken the U.S. as a top destination for new foreign direct investment. And according to the Ministry of Commerce in China, and you know, you can take their data with a grain of salt if you want to, but it looks like FDI into China, you know, not only hit a record last year, but is on set to hit a new record this year. So money's still flowing across borders. What about the fast money? So investors, are investors sending money into equity and debt markets abroad? Well, you know, a bunch of money flew out of emerging markets broadly at the beginning of the pandemic, and China wasn't excepted from that. But actually, almost every single month since then, we've seen foreign flows of money going into Chinese debt and equity markets. And so if you're looking at the hard data, the economic statistics, this narrative of deglobalization just doesn't stick.
Let me back you up for a minute to the world trade versus world goods thing, because I read your piece in the Financial Times, which hit, I guess, yesterday, Monday, and that was your first example. And I need you to unpack that. What does that mean and why does it matter?
Yeah, so, I mean, most economists can accept that part of globalization is trading goods and services across borders. Right. And so one way to try to gauge that is to say how much of this stuff is crossing borders. So how much trade do we have relative to how much activity we have, kind of a global economic activity. And that ratio, like I said, has just kind of gone sideways. It's bounced up and down a little bit over the past couple of years, mm-hmm. but there's no real indication that it's tanked since the pandemic hit.
Thanks.
So if onshoring isn't happening to a large extent, I guess that raises the question, should it? You know, do the things go mm-hmm. hand in hand? Did we decide mm-hmm. that onshoring needs to happen, but maybe it doesn't, or onshoring isn't happening and it still needs to?
So I think one of the reasons why politicians would like onshoring to happen is because goods producing jobs, so manufacturing jobs, tend to be high wage, high hour jobs. Those are the kinds of jobs that we want to be creating in our country. And so there is this idea that we lost a lot of those jobs to China, for example, when China joined the WTO, and we had the wave of globalization. That is true. We did lose some of those jobs, but we lost many more to technological innovation and automation. And so we're never going to roll that back, right? Even if we roll back globalization, we're not going to go backwards on the technological innovation front. And so those jobs, I think, just aren't coming back. And for companies that are making decisions about where to build their factories and where to get supplies from as inputs for their goods, they're making these decisions based on cold, hard, medium-term calculations about their bottom line. So they want to go to where it's going to be the cheapest, where they can into really sophisticated deep supplier networks where they can find really efficient ports so that they can actually get the goods and send them elsewhere, and where they can get access to talent and quality. And so even if, you know, there are places like Mexico that are much closer and could be slightly cheaper just in the shipping, they don't necessarily get all these other things from nearshoring. And they wouldn't get all these other things from onshoring back to the U.S. And so I think there's a reason that we globalized, and it comes down to companies' bottom lines. And, you know, Mexico was already closer to the U.S. than Asia, and yet we've had all this production in Asia for a reason. That reason isn't really changing much. And so I don't think that we're going to see deglobalization. What we might see instead is firms decide that we're not going to be entirely reliant on China as kind of the world's factory as we have been in the past. And so some production might stay in China. Don't forget, China's a really big market for a lot of these companies to sell into. So they'll want to maintain a presence. But they might also have another supply chain that goes through, for example, Malaysia or Thailand or Vietnam that they can use for inputs for goods that they're going to export to the rest of the world. So instead of getting deglobalization, we'll get this kind of China plus one strategy. And so that means maybe we're diversifying away from China. Our supply chains are changing a little bit, but we're not deglobalizing. I think globalization has gone so far and also makes so much business sense by now that we're never going to actually roll backwards on it. We might just globalize more slowly than we have in the past.
Can we talk about timescale here for a second? Because it's only been three-ish years, and supply chains get established literally over decades. And I wonder if we, and by we I mean you, economists, really, were sort of naive to expect to see changing patterns in just 3 years?
Yeah, I think it totally depends on the industry, to be fair. There are some supply chains that can repattern pretty quickly if firms are motivated, but you know, if you're going to go ahead and set up shop in a totally different country, you have to build infrastructure, you have to build factories. That takes a long time. So a great example is the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company has decided to build a big semiconductor plant in Arizona. And everyone's been very excited about the immediate change that this would pose to supply chains, but it won't be operational until 2024 at the very earliest. So to your point, it takes a long time and it significant resources in order to build new factories and new supply chains. And so I think it'll take a while, but also some firms are thinking, is this really worth us doing? It takes significant resources. Maybe we'll just stick where we are.
Yeah.
I wonder, this is a maybe slightly curveball question related to this, but there has been a lot of talk about domestic supply chains. And when we think about something that could disrupt this kind of diversification, but not deglobalization trend that does feel really likely, I wonder if that thing is climate. Like if there were all of a sudden a carbon tax on how much these goods had to move all around the world, involving a lot of like jet fuel and, you know, diesel, would that be a disruptor? Is that a reason for more domestic, you know, production and less travel?
Yeah, so you're right. Shipping and air freight are pretty carbon intensive. And so if we do decide that we're applying a carbon tax everywhere, that would incentivize companies to optimize based on minimizing the carbon emissions in their supply chain. So, you know, getting inputs from halfway around the world obviously isn't ideal. I guess I would question whether we're really going to embrace a carbon tax, an outright carbon tax. It seems like parts of the world, like Europe, have certainly embraced it. I'm not sure if you guys saw, I think The Atlantic wrote an obituary for the carbon tax in the U.S. because it was just so far off the table politically. Yeah, it's brilliant. You know, it's since come back into the political discourse a little bit. I think it's incredibly unlikely still. It's no longer completely impossible, but I think it's a long way off. And my base case scenario would be that the U.S. wouldn't actually embrace a carbon tax. Instead, there would sort of be an implicit indirect tax through lots of regulation. So it's not a real tax. It just has some of the same effects on businesses through regulation. And then you wouldn't have the same impact on supply chains. There's another option other than a carbon tax where governments and central banks decide they're just going to subsidize this green transition, which I think is also a possibility, in which case I think firms wouldn't need to worry so much about repatterning their supply chains so that they're more green. They would benefit from the subsidies in any way that they can implement green initiatives and green investments instead.
But in any case, really quick, Megan, just on the way out here, either one of those, figuring out some kind of carbon price or any of the other things, that's not happening tomorrow, right?
No, unfortunately not. Yeah. I think that's going to be a long way coming. And the longer we wait, the more abrupt the adjustment has to be. So the more disruptive it will be to growth and to supply chains as well.
Yeah. Megan Green, she's an economist, also senior fellow at the Kennedy School at Harvard, chief economist at Kroll. And she writes for the Financial Times sometimes too. Megan, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, so there you go. Capitalism doesn't care whether you live or die. As she said, it's all about the bottom line. It is. Right? I mean, literally.
I know. Yeah, totally. It honestly, capitalism cares about.
Speaking of which,
inputs.
Yeah.
You know, and so it really is a question of like, will American consumers say they want things that are made in the USA? Will there be some pricing pressure on carbon?
Right.
And I'm not suggesting that there will be. It's sort of just like, what will be the inputs that cause a change, if anything? And also, I just think it's so fascinating that everybody was like, oh, yeah, it's totally happening. No, it's not.
It's not.
Nope.
It's not.
It's not happening.
Super quick. I should have made this a news item, but just in the whole capitalism doesn't care whether you live or die. Did you see that Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, went to Hong Kong and was excused from the mandatory quarantine period because, says the chief executive of Hong Kong, well, it's a really big bank, really big bank, and it was a really important meeting. And I'm like, oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
Okay, sounds great. Good. Okay. That sure. Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is about as that's yeah. It's like
right?
Object lesson
yeah.
as it gets.
Yeah.
Jamie Dimon now officially in the Aaron Rodgers Club.
That's right.
Do whatever the hell you want, Club.
Yeah.
Delightful. All right, audience, what do you think though? Have supply chain issues changed the way you're shopping? Are you like my one friend who bought the Peloton because it's made in the USA as opposed to a cheaper option?
Mm-hmm.
Are you shopping locally for the holidays or anything? Let us know. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-82-SMART. You can also leave us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You just record it with your little computer speakers. So easy. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a really big bank.
And it was a really important meeting. It was a really important meeting. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Okay.
Like, really? We're doing that? Okay. I've got two, and the general category is technology is awesome, technology is terrible. Okay? So the first one, I'm going to start with awesome just because it's wild. So Steph Curry, basketball player extraordinaire, Golden State Warriors, and three-pointers out the wazoo and all this and that. So he, over the past number of years, has been working with a technology company to refine his shots. So for him, just making a swoosh is not good enough. That is to say, going in the basket without a net. Okay, this is a story out of the Wall Street Journal. Going to the basket with just hitting the net is not good enough. Steph Curry wants a swish within a swish. And so he's used technology to narrow the rim of the basket when he shoots so that every time it's going to be straight down the middle. And Steph Curry shoots at some outrageous percentage from the floor and from the three-point arc. And I just thought this was super, super cool. Here's a guy using technology to refine his already awesome skills. And I just thought that was amazing. Just thought that was
it is awesome.
Okay.
I'm going to be a little bit snotty.
Okay, go ahead.
We talked to Rachel Pike on Marketplace Tech in 2019.
Oh, there you go.
About exactly this, but that's it is awesome. So interesting.
Yeah, it's totally
cool. I mean, I love it. I love to see that she is like blowing up, and good job to the Wall Street Journal for picking that up. Yep. But I was like, wait a second. I think I talked to that lady. We'll have the story in the show notes.
Super cool. Super cool. Second one, technology is, I don't know. This is also out of the Wall Street Journal, and I'll just read you the lead. A group of investors is pooling millions of dollars in cryptocurrency in an attempt to purchase a rare first edition copy of the U.S. Constitution being auctioned off at Sotheby's. Contributors would not receive fractionalized ownership of the Constitution. Rather, they would get a governance token that allows possessors to advise on where the Constitution should be displayed, how it should be exhibited, and the mission and values of Constitution DAO, which is the group in question. Stop. Stop. Stop.
I don't even know how I feel about this.
Stop. Stop.
Wow.
Sotheby's figures it's going to go for $15 to $20 million. The group has raised 5.2 as of this morning, or around 1,211 Ether. So I don't think they're going to get it if they bid. You know, somebody like David Rubenstein is going to get it probably, because who can't use two or three copies of the Constitution? But yeah,
it is really interesting the one they're trying to buy, this is evidently the only copy that is currently in private hands,
right.
And the goal, at least, of this DAO, which is a decentralized autonomous organization, says they want to put it into the hands of the people. That's why they have the governance about where it would be displayed and
What could possibly go wrong? That's all I'm saying.
Well, I mean, we let like some rich guy buy it and put it in his house. So
he put it in the Capitol. David Rubenstein bought his and put it in the Capitol.
Wait, this one? This current one?
No, not this current one.
Right now?
No, not this current one.
Right.
The one Rubenstein bought.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm
saying.
This current one is the only one in private hands, and they're like,
right. Who kept it in his garage or whatever. Yes, true.
Right. I mean, certainly if the ownership changed or whatever, that's a question, but it doesn't seem any worse than.
Yeah, well, that's fair. Anyway, I don't even know.
It is weird, though, to think of, like, I don't know, when you have, like, crypto and rare copies of the Constitution in the same sentence, you're a little bit like, I don't know how I feel about
this. Yeah, no, I know. Sorry, wait. Very quick random thought for the producers listening down the line. We should do an episode on Ethereum and smart contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
true.
I don't know. Oh, Juan Carlos agrees. I don't understand them, and I feel like I should.
Is he nodding?
He is literally nodding, yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Right on.
So there you go. All right.
Also agree. Me. Yes, definitely do that.
Okay.
That was the first time I like said it.
I know, like in the past tense, like in the future imperfect or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ouch. This story broke yesterday. I'm just quickly changing the subject because it's not time for crying yet. A couple more days.
Totally fair.
To work on this. This story broke yesterday, and there were too many things in the lineup. I'm just going to be totally honest. And
fair
I
enough.
Was like, I will get my chance to talk about it. And it turns out that it has only grown in terms of coverage. And that is the story about how the Russian government conducted an anti-satellite missile test on Monday, blew up a satellite in space, causing all of the astronauts on the ISS, including two Russian cosmonauts, to have to take shelter because of the debris that, you know, went hurtling, such as things hurtle through space. And it's like not the first time it's happened, but somebody described it as, you know, a NASA scientist, as just sheer madness to blow things up, to shoot things out of space and create this increasing debris. And it is so, I just think it is such an interesting story because it's so sort of fundamentally anti-globe to do this sort of thing. So
that's a phrase. Like, sorry to laugh. That's a phrase.
Yeah, anti-globe, right? Or like anti-human, anti-humanity to do things like that. So, you know, there's this, not only is it dangerous to all of the people on board the ISS, but there's this theory called Kessler syndrome, which is that, or the Kessler effect, which I believe may be the premise of that movie, Gravity.
Gravity, yeah. The opening sequence of Gravity. Oh, that, have you not seen that?
No.
Oh, it's great.
It seemed like no, it had a lot of feelings.
Okay. Not till the end. Not till the end.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I'll think about it.
Yeah.
The theory is essentially a cascade. It was proposed by the scientists in 1978, and it basically said, okay, well, like if the density of the debris in space, because of space pollution, which we are doing all the time, is high enough that those objects start to collide with each other, then each collision generates more debris, increasing the likelihood of further collisions. And pretty soon you basically get an impenetrable wall of junk all around Earth. And I know that we don't like to think in terms of, you know, even 100 years, let alone like thousands and thousands. But like if we get stuck on Earth because of our own crap and become like Octavia Butler calls it smooth skinned dinosaurs. Okay. Like we go extinct because we cannot flee our own planet because we created so much crap with stupid stuff like this. Like, let's just shoot a satellite out of the sky and see if we can, or the space. Like, that's just going to be, in some ways, frankly, it occasionally feels like the fate we deserve. But like, come on, humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get it together.
Two very quick things. Number one, the United States has done these tests too, right? I mean, we haven't done them in like 10 or 12 years. So that's item number one. Item number two is it's a little bit off, but the whole Kessler syndrome thing is a little bit the way Seven Eves breaks down from Neal Stephenson, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that hole with the moon.
That's exactly
and
what it is.
I'm not going to give it away, but you know, that.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Yeah. That.
Juan Carlos is now looking at
the thing where, like,
three heads. He doesn't know what I'm talking about. But read the book.
I know, but everyone just go read it because that's exactly this, except the way, 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 way worse version.
Yeah.
Best case, we just get trapped on Earth and go extinct. Worst case, we ignite the atmosphere with all our junk.
Okay. Moving on.
Should we let someone else talk for a minute?
Moving on. It's not even Thursday.
It's only Tuesday and Molly's getting existential.
I know, right?
All right. Mailbag time. Hit it.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Long-time listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
We heard, and this is not that surprising since over 4 million people quit their jobs in August, but we heard from a lot of you who gave us a big old yes and to last week's episode on the Great Resignation or the Great Bye-Bye or the Big Bye-Bye. I'm trying to think of a word that starts with P so I can say the peace out. Anyway, plenty of people called and shared stories.
Prodigious, the prodigious peace out.
Ooh, the professional peace out.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm cracking myself up right now. Anyway, plenty of you did some version of this, and we made a montage. Here we go.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I'm one of the 4.3 million people who quit their job in August. I also realized that my job was a soul-sucking existence.
Oh, my God.
It's so nice not to be in a toxic place anymore.
I've been applying for similar jobs for years and never even got an interview before.
I left an 8-year career during the pandemic for something new.
And I put everything that I wanted on the table. I was terrified, but I got all of it.
I admit that I took a pay cut for this job, but there's more to work than salary.
8 months later, I'm in the running for a promotion because the guy above me quit.
Now I feel like I'm able to live the life that I want, and work is just another part of that.
That's like the last year and a half in a microcosm, right? That's the whole thing. It's crazy.
Yeah, wow. That is amazing. That is it. That is every economic report,
you bet.
Right? And quits rate, and
totally.
The this and that.
And the jolts and the
and a
and
bunch
the
of human
yeah.
voices. Wow. From, specifically, Patrick in Texas, Shara in Sacramento, Rachel in Dallas, and Ryan in Philadelphia. Apologies if it was Shara. Shara or Shara, one of those.
That was a good montage. Props to the producers.
That was great. Well done, producers.
And thank you all, by the way, for calling in with your stories. Keep doing that.
Yeah.
All right. Leave you today, as we always do, the answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Shreya in California has this.
Something I thought I knew that I very recently found out I was wrong about after the birth of my now 11-month-old. I thought babies were stinky little buggers. Between the spit-ups and the poopy diapers, I was prepared for all the odors. But I came to discover that despite the poops and the spitting, they actually smell quite lovely most of the time.
Well, that's true.
And on days when I feel crippling climate anxiety, that baby smell incites equal parts fear about her future, but also instills in me a steely resolve to fight tooth and nail every single day to leave her not just a livable, but a thriving planet. I guess what I'm trying to say is thank you to this podcast for continuing to have nuanced conversations about the climate emergency that go beyond the headlines. You are the podcast version of that new baby smell. Thank you, Kai and Molly.
Oh my God.
We are the podcast version of that new baby smell.
I mean, way to make a metaphor. Way to make, bravo, Shreya. That is beautiful.
That was a nice little turn. Nice little turn.
I may have teared up a little. Yep.
Send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question, whatever comments, whatever you want to say. We're here to hear it. Our phone number is 508-82-SMART.
Oh, man, I want to smell a baby so bad right now. Is that a weird thing to say? Okay, we'll be back tomorrow for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. I maybe shouldn't have said that out loud, but it's just a mom thing. There is, because the dogs, they stink. There's no... They act like babies forever, but they smell terrible. There is still time to send in your questions. Once again, 508-82-SMART is our phone number, or write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
Liv, my 14-year-old.
Somebody bring me a baby.
Well, no, Liv, my 14-year-old, said to my wife the other day, we were talking about whatever it was, and Liv was like, Mom, you can just pop another one out. And my wife looked at Liv, and she was like, shut up. Just shut up.
She's like, get away from me. Go ahead.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our intern is Grace Rubin. Tony Wagner writes our newsletters, but not the show page.
That's right. Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado with a great second on a story idea. Mixing by Emma Erdbrink, Ben Tolliday, and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music, which we use every day.
Every day.
The senior producer.
That was a serious question.
Is Bridget Bonner. It does sound a little different on Tuesday. I don't know why. Yeah. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
Ooh, you just made it. You just made it. Because the rule is, of course, when the music stops, you got to stop talking.
You got to stop talking.
It's the rules.
Hey, everyone. It's Drew. We're planning some special surprises for Molly before she leaves, and we'd love your help. Send us your goodbye wishes for Molly so we can share them with her on her last week. You can email us with your note or a voice memo attachment at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Just put goodbye note for Molly in the subject line or leave us a voice message. Our number is 508-827-6278. That's 508-UB-SMART. Thanks for your help.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi. I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.